In 1996, Alan Rucker had no real complaints. Married, two kids, a house in West Los Angeles. At the age of 51, his career as a television writer was looking up. He had a little knee trouble, but looked forward to a return to running. Then one day, a Tuesday, out of the blue, he started to feel a burning sensation around his waist. Inside an hour and a half, he was paralyzed from the waist down by a rare condition called transverse myelitis. It sounds like a nightmare, and he's had a few of those, but in his new memoir, Alan Rucker describes his new life with honesty, accessibility, and impudence. He titles one chapter, Cripple Do's and Don'ts. A little bit later in the hour, Newbery Award winner Susan Patrone joins us to talk about the one little word in her book, The Higher Power of Lucky, that's caused a big fuss. But first, Alan Rucker, his memoir is called The Best Seat in the House, or How I Woke Up One Tuesday and Was Paralyzed for Life. And we want to hear from you, especially those of you who deal with the same challenges as Alan Rucker. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. Alan Rucker joins us from NPR West in Culver City, California. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Hey, Neil. Good to be here.
And speaking of that one little word, there will be at least a few upset with your use of that word, cripple.
Yeah, or crip.
Or crip, which you also use.
Crip, that's what I learned very quickly, you know. When I became paralyzed, it happened so quickly that it was like starting your life over again, right? So I had to learn, you know, I had to learn how to behave. I had to learn how to talk. And what I heard among other people in rehab was that cripples call or people crippled. Cripple itself is an old term, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
People who use wheelchairs, that's the correct way of saying it, you refer to each other as crips. Now, you can't call me that, Neil, but, you know, someone else in a wheelchair can call me that. It's fine.
Indeed.
Not to be confused with the gang, the Crips.
I was going to say, does that make you a blood? But I was going to...
No.
Being from Los. Anyway, in your chapter, Cripple Do's and Don'ts, there's a whole list of things you go through. Words that those of us who are ambulatory or still ambulatory shouldn't really use.
Temporarily ambulatory, we like to say. Yeah, no, there are a lot of words that, I mean, I used them myself, even in referring to myself, till I was corrected by people who'd been in this condition longer. It's not a tragedy. Don't use the word tragedy, please. I don't suffer from it any more than someone, you know, suffers from bushy eyebrows or thinning hair. And, you know, there are a whole series of words like that that make it seem much worse and more tragic, I guess is the word, mm-hmm. than it really is. And that's what a lot of people, a lot of disabled people have to struggle with, which is that people think of them in ways that have nothing to do with their disability. It's just the associations people make with disabilities. Like that clip you use for Murder Ball, that people assume that someone who's disabled always needs help, is always, you know, is always out there, just, you know, it's heroic that he goes, that guy, in some people's mind, it's heroic that guy actually goes to the grocery store, you know. Boy, how did you get out of your car? Well, you know, you learn these things, you know, it's not that, it's not all that difficult.
It's interesting. In your very first trip to I think it was a Starbucks, to
yeah.
a mall, you were still in the hospital, still very much dealing with the discovery of this condition. And you said in that very first trip, two people shoved you out of the way to get into an elevator, and you began to realize. You learned later that this was hardly new.
Yeah, it was hardly new. That was a very strange trip. It was my first time to actually go across a street, which, even though I had help, I had an occupational therapist with me, it felt like I was a small dog crossing a big boulevard, you know? You felt so vulnerable. You feel very, very vulnerable when you first become paralyzed. And I go to the mall, and the first thing that happens is two people literally push me out of the way to get into an elevator. I guess they didn't see me or something. But the worst thing, which happens to a lot of people, is that little kids like to stare at you, right? They mm-hmm. wonder, why is that man, you know, riding around on wheels? And inevitably, their mother will grab their arm and jerk them like it's... And I never quite know what the message is. Watch it. He may be contagious. You never know. A guy like that could be weird. He may start babbling. Or it's rude to stare.
Mm-hmm.
It's not rude for a 40-year-old to stare, but it's stare at your legs and go, oh, there for the grace of God go I. But it's not rude for a five-year-old kid. You know, they just want to know what's going on.
Anyway. It took you 10 years to write this book, and it should be said, much of it is very funny.
Thank you.
Were you able to see it that way at first?
I started popping jokes to myself very early on, as a defense mechanism, which is what humor often is, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Laying in the on a gurney, I remembered thinking to myself, is this God's way of telling me I've told too many Christopher Reeve jokes? But I think the humor came. Someone asked me what was harder to write, the humor. Did you write the book about your life and then add the humor? And I said, no. I'm a comedy writer. I wrote the humor and then added the stuff about my life, you know. That was the hardest thing. The more serious parts of the book, the more telling, I guess you'd say, parts of the book were the hardest things to write, for sure.
And those are, you describe going through phases, that first phase in the hospital where you say it's equivalent to infancy. Then you get home and you have to relearn things that you learned first when you were 3 years old, toddler stage. And then after a few years, you get into the adolescent stage, and it reminded us all why none of us want to relive our adolescence.
You feel as self-conscious and as defensive as an adolescent when you kind of wander out into the world. And you always feel that people are condescending to you. And they often are, but it's usually out of kindness, not out of, the guy, the person who asked that kid, can I help you into your car, after he obviously had gotten out of his car to go shopping. It's not doing that to, you know, to put you down. They're doing that out of kindness, and it's the kindness that kills, you know, because it makes you feel less. It makes you feel, like you're more. It always makes you feel like you're more disabled than you actually are, and that's a that wears on you after a while. But you learn to deal with it. You know, I mean, it's not the end of the world when someone asks you 20,000 times a day, can I help you in your car? It's just, you know, it's just what happens, and you learn to deal with it. You know, it's not that weird. You actually outgrow the adolescence, I guess is what I'm saying.
Our guest is Alan Rucker. He's been in a wheelchair these past 10 years and wrote about it. He describes it as the best seat in the house. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And let's talk with Maggie. Maggie's with us from Rochester, New York.
Hi.
Hi.
About 6 years ago, I lost my eyesight, and I wasn't that old. I'm still not that old, but people tend to treat me as if I'm an old lady now. I went to a doctor's office yesterday, and they honeyed and sweetied me to death. You know, I just want to tell them, don't patronize me and call me honey and sweetie, but then I think, well, they'll think I'm some, you know, nasty old blind person, so I just don't say anything. I just swallow it. But I wish people would stop. And the other thing is, people say things to me like, you can cook? Oh, my goodness, you do so many things. I just can't believe what you do. Well, you know, I had help from the Association for the Blind, and those people who are telling me this, they'd be able to do things, too, if they had to. You know, you have to learn to
do
things.
That's absolutely right.
Okay.
Absolutely right.
I just wish they'd stop.
Yeah, they treat you as, I like to say that this experience has given me a kind of a head start on growing old.
Yeah.
I'm not that old, but since people treat you like you're old, you kind of have a sense about how old people are treated. And you're right, you don't want to be the disagreeable, I call him the disagreeable crippled, the disagreeable disabled. You don't want to be to say, no, get away from me, leave me alone, I can handle this, because, you know, that just puts people off, and you really do just have to swallow it and just go on.
Yeah.
But maybe it'll change, I don't know, it's really just habit, it's just a habit. You can imagine that 100 years ago, you know, people thought the disabled were, if you were in a wheelchair, you were also mentally disabled, and, you know, you were kind of shunned aside. And that doesn't happen anymore, but there's still this kind of self-consciousness that people have around people in wheelchairs that leads to people calling her honey.
Mm-hmm. I suspect
or yelling in your ear because they think you're deaf. How's the weather down there, you know?
Mm. You know what else they do? They ask my companion what I would like to sit there, would I like this or that, and sometimes I say to them, I'm blind, but I can still hear. You can talk to me.
That's exactly right. Where would he like to sit?
Yeah.
I don't know. Why don't you ask me? No, it's true. It's true. It's just, you know, I don't know. I think it's just habit, and I think that as baby boomers are turning 50 every 7 seconds, there's going to be a lot more people who are blind, who are in wheelchairs, who are disabled in one way or another, and it's going to become simply a more common experience for people. That's my hope. I really do think that.
Maggie.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say thank Maggie very much for her call, because I wanted to ask you before we run out of time for the break. There was an encounter with one woman, sort of a battle over a handicapped parking spot, which was really not a problem with somebody trying to be too nice.
No, that was a strange encounter. That was a woman who, for reasons I can't explain, decided that she was going to park in a handicapped spot. And she wasn't, you know, handicapped, and she wasn't going to leave. And she was so threatening to me that I tried to avoid her. When I finally found a handicapped spot, I tried to get way down in my wheelchair, you know, and mm-hmm. try to sneak between cars, because this woman was pretty ferocious. And until she said, what'd she call me? Hey, cripple boy or something.
Yeah, she said, I hope you got that way because somebody beat the tar out of you.
Yeah, beat the tar out of you. And I could consider that crossing the line. I mean, you know, you can yell at me, you can park in my handicapped spot, but don't make fun, you know, don't have a good time with my disability. And she finally, the police had to haul her away. She wasn't going to leave. She figured that, you know, she was a special person, too. A lot of people think that, you know, handicapped parking spots are kind of a special favor to people. And that's what they are. They are. It is favoritism, but they don't like it.
Our guest is Alan Rucker. His memoir, Best Seat in the House, How I Woke Up One Tuesday and Was Paralyzed for Life. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back after the break. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking with Alan Rucker about his book, Best Seat in the House, How I Woke Up One Tuesday and Was Paralyzed for Life. If you'd like to read an excerpt of the book about learning to live with paralysis, you can find it at our website, npr.org/talk. And, of course, you're welcome to join the conversation. If you have questions for Alan Rucker or if you deal with some of the same challenges he does, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org, and let's turn to Jim. Jim's calling us from New York. Jim, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay.
Coming back from the break, you surprised me. I was going to comment on why sometimes people in chairs can be disagreeable. I was at a Metro North station, the Suburban Railroad here, where the elevator was broken. So I was rolling down the stairs, an advanced cripple feat, something I was able to do in a controlled fashion, when I heard footsteps running down the stairs behind me, and I knew what was going to happen, and sure enough, somebody tried to help, knocked me down the rest of the flight of stairs, broke my chair, and the guy says to me, "Thank God I was here to help." Well, I couldn't believe it. Not to do anything worse. And one thing about kids, I tend to keep a couple tennis balls in my wheels, and that fascinates them and keeps them from being scared and makes me a little more approachable.
Right. That's cool.
But
the ability, Neil, excuse me, the ability to go downstairs in a wheelchair is a very advanced skill. I couldn't possibly do that.
That's
really
a
time. You're a super cripple. You make me nervous, you know, guys who can do that stuff.
I think it has something to do with when one becomes disabled. I was 18 at the time.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, I was full of spit and vinegar.
I wonder, when you guys get together, are there Ferraris of wheelchairs? Are there Buicks? You know, do you compare equipment?
Whenever I see a chair, I always check it out. There are, you know, some better, but I have to say the advances have slowed down a lot.
They're lighter now.
They're lighter, but, you know, but they were lighter. I'm in a chair 18 years, and they have an advance, you know, in the first couple years of my experience, there were a number of quick advances. Yeah. I don't think there's been any major advance in the past 10 years.
But Neil, when two guys in wheelchairs get together, they probably talk about what they're together for and not talk about their disability, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's not like the subject. I just don't want to be known as Alan disabled or Alan the guy in the wheelchair Rucker, you know? I don't want that to be the first topic of conversation, or especially not the only topic of conversation. And that's often a problem because, you know, people are just not used to seeing people in wheelchairs, or they're not used to, I guess, interacting with them. Maybe they're used to seeing them.
Well, we're so uncomfortable. Do you talk about it or do you not talk about it?
Usually I laugh about it, yeah. Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, we do you mention it? Do you not mention it? It's kind of the elephant in the room. Say, what do you think about the Cubs' chances this year? And by the way, you're there in a wheelchair.
Yeah, well, that's why when you go to a mall, people come up and announce to you that you're in a wheelchair as if you've forgotten it, you know? Hey, you're in a wheelchair. Hey, how's the weather down there? Hey, how did it happen, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's a way of breaking through their discomfort. You don't really have to see the chair first, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, what I find is if I'm out in public where the chair's very visible, right, people will often feel self-conscious. But the minute I pull in under a table, like at a dinner party or something, I'm just like anyone else, and they tend to forget about it. But I don't know. I just don't get the discomfort. Maybe I had the discomfort myself before I became paralyzed, but I don't get it. It's really, you can, you know, make a joke about it or say something about it and leave it at that.
Mm. Jim,
can I just throw something in here?
Yeah, go ahead.
There are 56 million disabled people in America. Stop and think about that figure. That's like one out of what, six or seven or something like that. But you never see them. I mean, they've done studies. The Screen Actors Guild did a study a couple years ago where they found that 0.05 of all speaking parts in film and television was a disabled actor or a disabled character, not just an actor, a disabled character. So they're kind of invisible to us. And I think that's a two-way street. Part of it is that people are uncomfortable around the disabled, and part of it is the disabled feel that people are uncomfortable around them, so they tend to be shy. They tend to stay at home, you know? And that's, you know, that's criminal on both counts. So it's just I think it really is breaking down. You know, my analogy is that when I first became disabled and I went to social events, I felt like the only black guy at an all-white Kiwanis Club meeting. I was invited. Everybody wants to make me feel normal, but they're just nervous and they just want to talk about, you know, Mike Tyson or real Southern barbecue as opposed to what I might want to talk about, you know?
Jim, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
So long. There are a number of things that normally might be awkward to ask you about, but I have license because you've written about them in your book. And one of them is dreams. Do you dream that you're in a wheelchair?
Never have seen a wheelchair in a dream. And I think that's a pretty common experience. Christopher Reed said that, too. He said he never dreamed that he was, paralyzed or in a wheelchair. Sometimes I walk funny in dreams. And I've even had dreams where I said, I'm running around this track with you, but this isn't really real. I'm actually paralyzed. So I've had conversations, but I have never seen if you're going to dream, you make up your dreams, right? Why make up a dream where you're in a wheelchair? You know, you'd probably... It not as fun as being ambulatory.
Mm-hmm. Sex.
Yeah, what about it?
Having any?
No. In my condition, I mean, there are a lot of disabled people who function perfectly sexually or function well. In my case, you know, I had to put that equipment on the shelf. But that doesn't mean that that I've lost any ardor for my wife or that we don't have our ways of being intimate, you know. I won't go into any more details than that. I don't want to.
And we thank you for that.
Do I want to use the word scrotum. It gets people in a lot of trouble.
It does, especially on the radio.
Right.
But I did want to ask, the way you write about it, your marriage was in some trouble before you got paralyzed, and in some ways through all the anger and pain and frustration and the laughs, too, you came out stronger.
We were under a lot of stress. I mean, I was a writer in Hollywood kind of toward the end of the fourth quarter of my career, and I had scratched and clawed my way to the middle of show business and hadn't made it much further and was overextended financially, and it was just a lot of pressure. I mean, I'm a freelance writer, and in this, it's probably the same as a freelancer in any business. It's a really precarious kind of life, and we had probably come pretty close to the edge when I became paralyzed. And you're right, a lot of anger and confusion came out of that, and it took us a couple years to work through it. And as I like to say, if my wife and I hadn't already been married for 30 years, we might not have made it. But we had, you know, a kind of reservoir of feeling there that helped us get through this terribly difficult time the first 2 years. And the marriage, it's funny, among people in wheelchairs or spinal cord injuries, the divorce rate is not very high because the majority of them are single men, you know, when they become paralyzed, when they get by accident, by and large, or sometimes by war. Mm-hmm. But the level of alcohol and drug use is way up. And, you know, it's just...
And that was my next awkward question. Did self-medication come into your ken at any point?
Not really. I knew that was an option. Even, you know, it's all, what does Dick Cheney say? It's all on the table, right? Mm-hmm. Heroin was an option, right? Anything, you can use it, you know, paralysis for an excuse for anything. But I found that if I had more than two glasses of wine, I started to lose my balance, and it's no fun to be at a dinner table, you know, a dinner party, and all of a sudden be on underneath the table because you fell over because you had 2.5 glasses of wine. So there's a built-in governor as far as I'm concerned. Maybe not with younger guys, but with me, who has poor balance, right?
Let's see if we get another caller on the line. This is Rick. Rick's calling us from Louisville, Kentucky.
Yes, I became disabled at 47 with a muscle disease, and I'm not in a wheelchair, but I have great difficulty walking, and I have trouble standing up, and I don't walk normal. And one of the things that I noticed is that people don't make eye contact with me.
Right.
And I have a real good story about that. I would take my daughter swimming. She was on a swim team, and when we walked into the pool area, when I would look up, all the parents in the stands would immediately look to the side. So I made a little game out of it. Every time I would walk in, I would be looking at the ground and look up all of a sudden, and it was like being at a tennis match where everybody's heads would turn to the left. And
scene in Strangers on a Train where everybody's watching the ball in the crowd except for one guy, Robert Wagner, who's of course watching his partner in crime. Anyway, I don't know why I brought that up. Anyway, go ahead.
No, it's a great reference.
One more quick story. My daughter also plays tennis, and I used to play back before I became ill. And even though she's a good tennis player, I always have people, other parents, start explaining the rules of tennis to me as if I'm an idiot and have never, you know, played and don't understand it. They just automatically assume that I know nothing about sports or how to play the games. Hmm. And so it's really humorous. You know, I don't take it offensively, but it's pretty humorous.
All right, Rick. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
So long.
Bye.
And before you email, I know, Robert Walker. It was Robert Walker, not Wagner. Anyway, here's an email we got from Leslie in Rochester, New York. I was stricken with transverse myelitis on November 14th, 2005. At 3 a.m., I fell down and have yet to stand up again. I was 52, am female, and African-American, which in our society seems to be a pile of challenges. I'm still learning how to manage in a wheelchair. I live alone, lost my job because of my disability, and hope to find some support in rehabbing my house. Meanwhile, I live far from home in another city in an accessible space. This year has been hell, and I pray each day to walk again that a fix is found. You found yourself, there was a possibility in your initial diagnosis that you might be able to walk again, and you really sort of assumed for a while that you would.
Oh, I absolutely assumed. Transverse myelitis is a very rare and often difficult to diagnose ailment or disorder. But in many cases, people after the initial, it's an inflammation of the spine caused either by a virus in your spine or at least your immune system thinking that there's a foreign element in your spine. But many people recover after the initial inflammation dies off. Nerves have a way of, you know, reconnecting, et cetera. In fact, 2/3 of the time, people have some kind of recovery. So I figured, well, that's good. I'm healthy. You know, I was a runner. I'm in good shape. I'm sure to recover. And that first year of hope, really, was really what kept me, I think, really what kept me going. And it wasn't until a year in that, you know, another doctor, not even my own neurologist, said, "Hey, bud, you'll never walk again." And that was a shock, but it was a shock that came after a year of adjustment. So it was very, you know, it was easier to, it was not easy to take, but I think it was easier to take. Hmm. Remember the book Black Like Me in the early 60s?
Sure.
About a reporter who somehow, you know, added pigment to his skin so he could be like an African American and kind of see how they saw the world. I thought my title of my book was going to be Paralyzed Like Me, because I thought I was going to recover and then I could look back and see what it was like to, you know, be disabled from an ambulatory point of view, and I just never recovered. So, gave me kind of a perspective on it, though.
You had a couple of other suggested titles for the book.
Well, my favorite, which the editor summarily dismissed, was Farewell to Legs. A Farewell to Legs. I thought that was perfect, you know? Had that little Hemingway twist, but they didn't like that. And Spinal Destination was also one.
I like that one.
My kid came up with that one, Spinal Destination. They said, "No, you never want to use the word spine in a book title. That's not good. People don't pick up books that have the word spine in them." Or death. Best is good, though. Having the word best is a good word.
Free is probably good, too. We're talking with Alan Rucker. His book is actually titled Best Seat in the House. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Sarah on the line. Sarah's calling us from Louisville, Kentucky.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Mr. Rucker, I have a disabled sister. She was born with spina bifida, so I grew up in a household that was sensitive to disability, yet we strove to triumph over it, the limitations, as often as possible. And I've worked for the last 14 years for an airline, and I often find myself in a position of not offering enough assistance because I grew up in a home where most of the time my parents said, well, try to do it yourself first before anyone else pitched in. So there is a little bit of disparity about when to give enough help. I know most people that I know growing up that were disabled would have preferred less help, but actually out there, I think people, at least when they travel by air, wish that we had more to offer. And I just wondered what you thought of that, and I'll take my comments off the air, Neil. Thank you.
Okay, Sarah, thanks.
It is, you know, I guess it's hard for people sometimes to know whether to help. You can always ask, you know, if you ask, and, you know, usually people just say yes or no, yeah, I could use some help. Or, you know, the disabled will just say, you know, I'll need an aisle chair to get on an airplane. It is amazing, though, in air travel, how the people that are always helping you on the plane, because, Neil, you usually have to go from your chair to a little narrow chair called an aisle chair to get to the seat, right?
Yeah.
They every time it seems like this is the first time they've ever done it. It really does. And I don't know, maybe they cycle those people through, or maybe they're not that many people in wheelchairs that travel. I don't know, but it always seems like the first time. But it is tricky, you know, but the best thing is just to ask. It's not going to, you know, can I help you? You know, it may even be a little condescending or irritating to the disabled person, but it's, you know, it's an honest reaction.
Here's an email we got from Richard in Placerville, California. My wife is quadriplegic as a result of 23 years of MS. We are not old, 47 and 50, and go to a lot of places and do just about anything that we can get her chair into. If people want to help us, open a door once in a while and stay the hell out of the handicapped bathroom stalls. You have a choice. We don't. And thanks for mentioning sex. My wife is still a knockout, and I catch men eyeing her in public. Imagine how lucky I am to be going home with her.
Well, that's a great attitude.
Yeah.
Open the door. Doors are good. That's good. Open the door.
And stay out of the handicap stalls.
Stay out of the handicap stalls. Curb Your Enthusiasm, the HBO show, had just an hysterical episode where Larry David, the character, and kept arguing with a guy. I mean, a guy dressed him down about being in the handicap stall. And then later on, when the handicap stall was full, he found this guy in a regular stall. And, of course, he dressed him down. But it's a pretty common thing. It's all these little social cues. Basically, the whole idea is that, you know, this is not my identity, Neil. Although we've spent, you know, a good time today talking about it, being disabled is not my identity. It's just something that happened to me, any more than a lot of other, you know, features of my life or my identity.
Well, next time you come on, we'll ask you to tell Anthony Edwards stories.
Okay, great.
Jeff, Alan Rucker was our guest. His new book is The Best Seat in the House, How I Woke Up One Tuesday and Was Paralyzed for Life. He joined us from NPR West. When we come back from a short break, the debate over where to draw the line when it comes to language in children's books. 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.